This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak radio show. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday and Wednesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our site at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to past shows on our iPod Ready archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. You can also listen to us via satellite on your Nokia phones. Go to the website for details. For our listeners, you can also call in during our show internationally, toll-free, 877-489-6350, and toll-free in the United States and Canada at 888-228-4494. Once again, I'll repeat those numbers. 877-489-6350 and toll-free in the United States and Canada at 888-228-4494. We have tonight with us the former Attorney General of the United States, Mr. Ramsey Clark. Mr. Clark proved to be a vigorous defender of civil rights and civil liberties. He opposed the use of government wiretaps, initiated the first Northern school desegregation case. After leaving the government, he taught law and later became active in the anti-Vietnam War movement, visiting North Vietnam in 72, and in 74 he was a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate of New York. I'll tell you, I am sorely disappointed, Mr. Clark, that you didn't make it because we need people like you in our government. Welcome to our show, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I didn't make it. I would have been ruined, but here I am.
I guess so. I don't know if it's... let me ask you a question. A lot of people are going to see you as an enemy of America. Who is Ramsey Clark? Is he good for America or is he bad for America?
Well, I think America will have to decide that. I see a different America than many do. I don't see our country as acting in accordance with its founding principles of freedom and fundamental rights protected and equal opportunity for all and hopefully peace and justice. I think we've been weak on that. If you really love your country, I think you have to stand up and demand that it do right when you feel, even though you might be wrong, that it's not acting in accordance with the principles that are good for children.
Mr. Clark, do you see that the constituency of the United States of America is almost shallow sometimes? One day we have heroes, and the next day we denigrate them and call them war criminals. Where is your position when you defend people, some of the most infamous people in the world, as you have been called the war criminal's best friend? You've been called mysterious. You've been called, your work has been questioned. Who are you working for? Can you tell us why you defend what people seem to feel are the indefendable?
Well, I started out believing that their presumption of innocence was really a fundamental principle of life, that you keep an open mind until all the evidence is in. That prejudice is the enemy of truth. And to find truth, you have to be open-minded, and sometimes you're quite surprised it wasn't what you expected. So to me, the presumption of innocence is it's a code of life. I keep an open mind on all people. And frankly, I don't believe in evil. I don't believe in demonization. I watch history and I see how we so demonize an individual or a group or a whole society or people because of race or whatever that if you suggest they may be human or have some human qualities, your peers in your own country begin to condemn you for it. So that's never really affected me. I've always opposed the death penalty, for instance. Death penalty, you know, without exception, involves people who have been alleged to have done a terrible thing, because you don't execute people unless you believe they've done it, or at least you're not supposed to, unless you believe and prove they've done a terrible thing. And I've always had to, the only way I can do it, I don't know whether the prosecution's right. And I put forward all the evidence that I can find that bears on guilt or innocence, and then let an independent-minded jury decide, even though the events for which they're charged may be terrible. And that's the way I look at foreign leaders, too. Right now we're working on an interesting matter with the Indian Geronimo, who was so demonized that everybody wanted to kill him. And, but when you look at his life, you see that he was much more a victim. When he was in his early 20s, his mother, wife, and three children were all murdered in a raid on a camp that didn't have warriors or young babes there to defend them. They were just slaughtered. He came back, found that situation, and then we began to demonize him. Now he's come out of that cloud, but it took 100, he'll be 100 years anniversary of his death is February of 2009. If you look at the people overseas, the people that were involved in countries that we were opposed to, that I represented to a large extent, and I've always felt it's important for somebody to reach out to show that we don't presume guilt. We have lawyers in our country who will defend people that our country has politically opposed and demonized, and we'll try cases and see how they come out, see what the truth is, see if we can persuade. And if you can get a fair trial, which is the hardest thing in those cases, because the political interests are so intense, you may teach history something. But even if you don't, you at least tell their people that not everyone in America thinks you're evil or part of an evil empire and condemned by the president, and therefore you ought to be burned at the stake or something. That they'll come and see whether you're really as bad as it says, if you really did what they claim you did, and how it compares with what they did to you. Take Geronimo.
When you talk about over demonizing, I believe I know for a fact that there have been probably popes in the world that have committed more heinous crimes than Saddam Hussein, yet Saddam Hussein was touted as the second coming of Hitler. Was he over-demonized?
Well, I agree with the poet that comparisons are odious, but it's just so ridiculous for a grown person to make comparisons to things that are totally unlike. Germany in the 30s is like Iraq in the 70s, 80s, 90s. They're entirely different cultures, entirely different people, entirely different circumstances, entirely different levels of power. There's no comparison. What you're really doing is you're identifying hatred among your own population, hatred that already exists, and then you're comparing something that is not comparable at all to that hatred. So that you can transfer that hatred to this new object. But the idea that, if you did a psychological examination of Hitler and Saddam Hussein, you'd find they're the same, it just makes no sense. It's a means of bringing hatred, from prior experience, to a new situation.
May I, Mr. Clark, we're talking about some of the most heinous criminals in the world, according to some. Here we're saying that they are not, some of them are being over-demonized. Where do we fit in the United States of America, in placing many of these people in the power roles that they have?
Well, we've been pretty good at it.
I guess you're right.
let's take three countries that join each other. Iraq, Iran, and Pakistan. And you find that in Iran, we placed the Shah on the throne in 1953. Mm-hmm. We were responsible for the overthrow of the democratic election of a president, a man named Mossadegh. Mm-hmm. That the Shah ruled Iran to our benefit for 25 years. That the director of the CIA, who was in for part of that action, William Colby, said that the proudest achievement, this is after the Shah was overthrown by a nonviolent revolution, incredible revolution, in which the people just took to the streets and they didn't have guns, they just had bodies. And finally the Shah left, killed 45,000 that last year, 1979, as many as he dared, and he left because he said, well, I can't kill everybody, I don't have anything left to govern. But during that 25 years, he was our man. He bought $26 billion in arms from the United States between 1972 and 1976. He reigned tyrannically over the people. The Savak police were in everybody's business, and cruel torture. And we had enormous profit from he became a regional economic distribution center for American corporations. It was fabrication plants and warehouses for shipments, transshipments, and sales in Iran. They had the oil money that we were benefiting from. You go over to Pakistan, and you find that a democratically elected leader, really the first democratically elected leader in the history of Pakistan after India was broken up and freedom came at midnight, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. He had studied in the United States. He'd run for president of the student body just a little bit south of you there at Berkeley. He was a student there, if you can imagine, a Pakistani leader. And we were responsible, basically, for his overthrow and for the placement of General Zia-ul-Haq. He gave him more than a brutal decade of military dictatorship. Then, of course, Benazir Bhutto was elected, and he was run out of the country, and then another one of the present leaders there now, and the democratically elected new body, had a brief term at prime minister, and then Benazir came back briefly, and then you've got Mushar, who we've supported all these years against the will of the people. So they've had years and years, decades of military dictatorship for the benefit of the United States. Iraq, I don't need to tell you about it. I mean, what we've done to Iraq, what we have done to Iraq, the sanctions that we imposed on Iraq, and went there every year during the 90s, during the sanctions, and they were genocidal. At least 1.5 million people were killed by the sanctions, and half of them were children under the age of 5. And we knew we were doing that. I took evidence of it done. Numerical, statistical evidence, the causes of death, place of death, times of death, and the highest leaders in the country, and told them this is what the scientists are doing. And they kicked them on. They kept bombing from time to time. No fly zones and all the rest. Killed probably the greatest woman artist in modern times, and perhaps in all of the Arab states, but certainly in Iraq, led on a tar with a Tomahawk cruise missile in her home 12 miles from the center of Baghdad, killing her. And, so we haven't been very good for those countries. If you look at Africa and you realize that we overthrow a democratically elected president in Congo and put on someone who's worse than Idi Amin, in the Grange for 30 years. Now the Democratic Republic of Congo, he changed the name to Zaire, and the people yep. suffered terribly, and we profited. So we're pretty good at what we do. Pretty brutal people.
And we're pretty good at what we do. Mr. Clark, we have a ton of questions, but there are just a couple more points that I'd like to hit on before we start taking our questions from our listeners.
Okay.
I'd like to ask you something. You know, earlier this evening I was talking to a friend, and he had said he had spoken to a friend of his in Iran and that they were scared. Will we attack Iran, or will we allow Israel to attack Iran?
Well, it's a terrible question, isn't it? Because we ought to realize that it's an international crime to attack another country. If it's a war, it's a war of aggression, which is supreme international crime. If it's an attack, it's a commission of a violent act against another country with deadly force. Countries can't do that. It's a criminal act. And the question of whether we will, the thing that should be clear to everyone who follows international events and follows the words and deeds of our president, he has said in every place he's been for the next 3 months, the last 3 months, that we cannot permit Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. We can't permit this crazy leadership. We can't permit this evil empire to have a nuclear weapon. But to do so would condemn future generations, and we have to be bold enough to prevent that, to stop it before it happens. Now they're leaking stuff that says that the general scientist from Pakistan who is peddling some of the information on how you make a bomb had been to Iran, and that they have benefit from his knowledge that enables them to build the bomb, and this urgent matter that we can't let it go on. He talks to the Knesset one of the most incredible speeches a president ever made abroad, which he says to an audience that has a large sector, it's not a majority, I don't think, in the Knesset, that favor striking Iran, which would remain to be the last large and powerful enemy in the region, this is from their perspective. So he's telling it every place he goes. Would he benefit from it? I think he thinks he would benefit in a number of ways. First, it would protect the oil. Iran is right on the border there. Iran is three times the population of Iraq. Iran is not debilitated as Iraq has been from since the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War in 1980, but Iran has been free of war since 1988 with the end of the Iran-Iraq War, and it's powerful, it's got oil income, it's enabled it to build a strong country, and it's right there on the border. So to protect the oil, and the headline of the New York Times today is that it's unbelievable that we think before the end of the month Iraqi oil will be tied up by non-competitive contracts by the great major oil companies, the Seven Sisters, so to speak. It's not quite that. The four that had it before, beginning with Exxon and Shell and BP, they're going to add in Chevron and a few other smaller companies. We tied up every Arab oil country has prevented that for 20 years now, and here we're going back 20 years to tie up their oil, just as we're trying to tie up permanent military bases there. If he strikes Iran, they have to have the U.S. there because Iran's big and they can come in. They'll be coming in. They'll be hitting everything they can because they can't sit there and the United States get three or four of their nuclear sites. The Shah had a huge plan for nuclear energy. His whole idea was, I want to give my people permanent energy, and the oil's going to run out, and I want them to have nuclear energy in place before it runs out, and they'll never have to worry about energy. That was part of the Shah's plan. I visited the Atomic Energy Commission there in 1978, and the guys were going crazy, the women too, but they were none of the scientists in those days. Just help going crazy because of the absurdity of his plans. He just, it was arbitrary and all the rest. So you've got this, that it's the way that the United States assures its protection of its oil that it's tying up there at its permanent bases in Iraq, which it wants for not only Iraq, but to police the whole region. After all, Iran's border is not 50 miles from Kuwait. Kuwait's not defensible. And Saudi Arabia is right on the other side of Kuwait, which is a tiny country. So the whole region's oil, Emirates.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, today I heard that King Abdullah and a few of the other oil and Middle Eastern oil companies and countries were going to be meeting in some grandiose meeting. So we'll see what develops from that. We have a ton of questions here for you.
What's the other reason? If I could go by quickly, why President Bush thinks it'd be in his benefit. Israel would appreciate it, of course. Also, his legacy. He will present it as he's the one that had the courage to prevent Madden from getting hold of nuclear weapons. If you really want to do that, there's only one way. You can't tell other countries under any circumstances that I know of in the history of humanity. They can't do something that you're doing. And here he is spending
billions. Well, we've already done that, though. Isn't that exactly what we are doing? And if that's the legacy of President George Bush, I see a different legacy. I see the Patriots Act, the loss of habeas corpus, warrantless wiretaps, NAFTA, Iraq, Afghanistan, crisis. That's what I see as the legacy of George W. Bush.
I'm talking specifically about developing nuclear weapons, though. He's spending more to develop a new generation of nuclear weapons than the rest of the world is spending combined on nuclear energy. He's got four new generations of weapons coming up. There will be tactical weapons and other weapons at the same time that he's telling North Korea and any enemy that he picks that you can't do that. If you do, we'll blast you off the face of the earth. Which means that any country that wants to protect itself and stand up has to have a bomb, because then you don't dare attack them. So what you will have to do is go back to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and do what you promised to do in 1968 and 69 when you signed it. And that is say, we will eliminate our weapons upon the agreement of all the non-nuclear powers never to develop a weapon. And then you can have an inspection system for everybody to show that we're eliminating ours and the other nuclear powers today are eliminating
ours. But then we'd have to inspect Israel, and we've done that, and we came out looking like chumps when we walked away from Israel with no developments on that. Yeah, we attacked a nation of people for less than that in Iraq.
We can't inspect it. It's got to be an international commission. We already have an international commission. And,
exactly.
It's like inspecting ourselves to inspect Israel. That's kind of a bad joke.
Exactly. I have a phone call for you. Steve from Santa Fe is on line 3. Mr. Clark, Steve, do you have a question for Mr. Clark?
Yes, and thank you first, Mr. Clark, for your patriotism and for standing up as you have throughout the years. I'm really worried about Israel. I see that the major unrest in the area is because of Israel and the horrors that it's committing both in Gaza and in the West Bank. When is America going to wake up and do something about AIPAC and the different political action committees that are causing the United States to go against Islam and make all these enemies? Now listen online, and thank you, sir, for taking my question.
Well, good to hear you, and I thought it was heartbreaking to watch Democratic and Republican and other candidates go before AIPAC this year and bend their knee as if they were before the king. But it's interesting to see what George Bush is doing now to weaken Palestine. I represented the PLO for 25 years, up until 2 years ago, going back to the 70s, and Palestine has never been in the terrible plight they're in now, and the worst part of the plight now is for the first time they're really fighting each other. We're trying to stir up a civil war, as has been reported in many places, but what President Bush told Palestine on his last trips there, which will go tomorrow, he said, you support us, talking to Fatah, you support us, and you're going to get a country. If you support us, you're going to get a country, is what he says. You don't support us, and you're going to get Gaza. Take your choice. Whatever.
Wow.
Whatever.
Thank you very much. John from the Canadian Rockies, Mr. Clark. In 1970, I was involved with this is a text question from John. He asked, Mr. Clark, in 1970, I was involved with the Citizens Coalition for the Impeachment of Nixon and Agnew. Because of the illegal invasion of Cambodia long before Watergate, we flogged a petition day in and day out in the streets of New York City and across the U.S., engaging people in discussion and debate. What in your estimation, prevented such public involvement in the case of this criminal that now is in the White House?
Well, it's a number of things. First, it's our political system is captive of wealth and power, so you can't get representatives to act on it. Few exceptions. There are about 25 members of the House. Minister Kucinich, as you know, has just filed a new resolution of impeachment, 35 counts. A good one. But you can't get the Congress can't get the Democrats to act, but they're about, and part of the reason is that they're all tied in with their contributors and military industrial employers in their districts. They're all tied in and tied down that way. But if the people got up, they'd have to react, particularly when an election year, you know, every member of the House is going to be, it's going to face, unless they're not running, it's going to face an election contest. If we can really get the people up, so why aren't the people up? We've been working, I worked on Nixon's impeachment, I thought we kicked it off. I was chair of the National Advisory Committee of the ACLU, and we kicked it off in Brown University. And actually, of course, proceeded toward impeachment, and he resigned when he realized he was good at counting heads in the Senate. He'd gone that far, and he thought he'd be convicted, so he resigned and got pardoned. But here, we've had an impeachment sign up since about 3 weeks after 9/11. After shock and awe in March of 2003. It took us all this time to get about 1,100,000 votes to impeach. It used to be called votes to impeach, and that's called impeach Bush, impeach Cheney, and others too. And the reasons I think are several, and some are deep and very difficult. One is our consumerism. We've become so involved in materialism and wanting things and thinking. I mean, even my grandchildren going to the mall, but their greatest joy, you know, they're shopping, mindless shopping, the proliferation of unnecessary necessities, as Mark Twain called it. They're such a diversion that in our value system, we don't see the importance of what our own government is doing. We're more worried about the price of gas than we are the lives of children in Iraq and elsewhere in the world.
Absolutely. I think that our priorities are probably pretty screwed. 911 holds more questions than answers for, and more of the questions arose after the 911 Commission report. What are your thoughts on that and on the event itself, Mr. Clark? Do you believe that that we were attacked from the outside?
Well, I have a position I've come to on those things. It's hard to find the truth about some things, and if you dwell too hard on them without seeing their meaning and consequence, it's the same with the assassinations. You're missing the main thing. You look at what it was. It was terrible, but how would you compare being in the World Trade Center with being in Hiroshima that day? So we have to realize that as awful as the deaths that were caused here were, they were minor and compared with what we have done, and not batted an eye. And what
exactly.
We do now.
Exactly. Thank you. That's a very big point.
Compare it with 750,000 children at the age of five in Iraq, and we don't even pay attention. It's unbelievable that we could do that. But she walked through those hospitals and walked through the maternity ward and seen the mother sitting on the bed, which all they always do, and the baby, and all of a sudden you hear this wail. It's their culture. We can't wail. We're too embarrassed. But when a woman loses her baby, she wails. There's just no inhibition whatsoever. She's heartbroken and she can't help it. She just wails. And we don't seem to be able to address that. I don't know who did it. I'm not going to spend my energy and time doing it. I know that our reaction to it has been about as violent and misdirected and wrong-headed as it can be. We've made enemies. We've made the probability of other people wanting to hurt us much, much higher. And so we're contributing to it. And you know, we're already the largest military spender in the world, but we're now the largest in the rest of the world combined. And we're wrecking our own economy and self-destructive things that will hurt far more people. Terrible things happen. And you stand up and you face them like courageous people and say, we're going to develop a foreign policy to prevent that from happening again. We're going to love our neighbor. We're going to work with our neighbor. We're going to have some trust and respect. We're not going to go around wildly calling people evil empires and threatening them all the time. No one likes to be threatened. I don't get angry very often. I try to be calm, and I'm called a soft-spoken person. I think I probably am. But when somebody threatens me, it gets me a little irritated, I have to admit. And I think that's it. I think that's common in human nature, and if you want to make enemies, it's a good way to do it. And I think he wants to make enemies, President Bush, because that's the way he supports his programs, and that's the way you build the military, and that's the way you exploit foreign peoples.
We have a caller, Seth Kesko from Massachusetts, is on line 3. Seth Kesko, you have a question for Mr. Clark, please?
I do. Hi, Mr. Clark, and I'm calling first, to thank you for your efforts for Leonard Peltier in the past, and my questions are actually two parts. I'd like to know, first of all, in your opinion, what you think Leonard Peltier's chances of getting out of jail are, and also, would you consider continuing to aid Native peoples on issues in the United States?
Could someone repeat that to me? Just the last part, I didn't get it.
I'm sorry, Kesko. Seth Kesko, can you repeat the last part, please?
Yes. What do you think Leonard Peltier's chances are of getting out of prison?
Mm-hmm.
And would you consider continuing to help Native peoples in a consulting fashion with various issues?
I got the Leonard Peltier part. I'll answer that first, and then I'll have to hear something on that makes me unable to hear about my phone. I had to tell Leonard Peltier a very sad thing that one time I was in, I went to all the prisons when I was in the government. At the prison, one time I came up on a prisoner and he was sitting out in the sun. It was in Segalville, Texas. It was a model prison that came in. An old man, white hair, and he's sitting up against a building in the broiling sun. I went over and walked up to him. I was with the warden and I said something. He didn't look up. I patted him on the head. He looked up and he was senile. And I turned to the woman and said, what's this about? What's he doing here? She said, oh, he's been here since 1926. She said, he was convicted of participating in a bank robbery in Oklahoma where an FBI agent was killed. So we've been trying to get rid of him. This is the way the warden, but we've been trying to get rid of him for years and years because, you know, we're not an old folks home. We don't know how to change diapers and stuff like that. It's not our field of work. He shouldn't be here, but we can't. Every time we try and get him out, the FBI says, if you kill an FBI agent, you never get out.
Unbelievable.
He's convicted, but I think wrongfully, of killing two FBI agents. Having said all that, I believe in justice, and I believe if people stand up, they can get it. And I think if we work hard enough, you know, we're 100 years after Geronimo's death, we're trying to get justice for him. He spent his life from 1886 to 1909 in prison. He's still in prison in Oklahoma at Fort Sill. Can you believe it? His bones, unless they're up in Skull and Bones in Yale University.
Oh, my God. How fascinating. Thank you. Jeanette from
Michigan.
The second
part of that question, if you wanted, I didn't get it.
I'm afraid I didn't either. I apologize, Seth Kesko. We are still experiencing a little bit of difficulties due to the fire at our broadcasting network, but I know that you guys are all patient with us. Thank you very much. Jeanette from Michigan asked, Mr. Clark, were you Secretary of State during the USS Liberty? Have you ever heard any fact that convinces you the Israeli version of the attack was true? And can you explain the U.S. support of Israel in light of the fact that they obviously do not respect us?
Well, I wasn't ever Secretary of State. I was Attorney General.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's what
That's not important. I was, you know, part of the government, and I was concerned about everything we're doing, including Vietnam. And I think Israel has shown a number of times through a number of leaders and governments that it does what it wants to do. It's a little cautious where it's inconsistent with our interests or even our lives. But I think it's very careful to cultivate support and friendship in the United States because it needs us. And wouldn't have existed except for us. I mean, President Truman, who was a good man in many ways, but some of these problems are hard to handle, hard to think about, particularly when you come out of World War II and see World War I as he come out of, and then watched what happened in World War II. And he get desperate, so he drops the bomb. But he also phoned within 2 hours after Israel declared its independence in 1948 and recognized them. And since then, we've spent, you couldn't count the billions of dollars in military and non-military aid to them, more than the income of the Palestinian people, our aid. But they don't, you can't say they're entirely ungrateful, and we have, there are tens of thousands of people with dual citizenship, U.S. and Israeli citizenship.
Yes, absolutely. Sherry from Michigan, what are your thoughts on the planned countersuit by some members of the military against Congressman Murtha now that they have been found innocent by a military judge in the Haditha killings?
Yeah, you read that pretty clearly, but there was a turn in there that I didn't quite get.
Which part?
Who's suing Murtha?
I don't know. I guess some of the members of the military that were actually indicted on the Haditha killings.
Yeah, sure they were. Yeah, we haven't followed up. I mean, our military prosecutions for criminal offenses against the people of Iraq have been shameful. If you look at the numbers that have been killed, you have to empathize to some degree with a youngster who's maybe a woman these days, and because we've got quite a few in the armed services and in combat situations, and it's frightening, and you can get killed. You step on a bomb, you get shot if you put your head around that corner. So you often shoot first and ask questions later. And sometimes you just, you know, you may have lost a buddy or something recently, or you may have seen some car get hit, some Humvee or something get hit, and you get angry, you just go into the house and shoot everybody. But those things have to be prosecuted, but you have to remember, too, that time and time again, we're sending people into Fallujah and places like that, and we know we're going to have to be killing more civilians than soldiers. We're trying to clear an area, and so one thing you have to say is war is hell. But even so, you ought to have a military justice system that holds its own people to accountability for criminal acts.
Absolutely. Well, we can't even hold our own president to accountability. We're still working on that. You know, Mr. Clark, we're currently trying to pass the bill to impeach President Bush, And if you think for one moment, as to our listeners I'm saying this, that impeachment is not justifiable, then you have to ask yourself one question. What has happened to the color alerts in America? Are we safer? No. Are there less terrorists in the world? No. Are we more secure in America? No. So what happened to the alerts, and why are we not in constant orange alerts like we were pre and post shock and awe? I find that to be unbelievable, the number of people that were so frightened and inspired to hatred, inspired to revenge, inspired because of those kinds of alerts. And look, here we are in a worse situation than we've ever been in the United States history, and we don't even have any alerts anymore. I wonder what happened to them.
Well, they've got new ways to frighten the people. They're more more alarming and emotionalizing and more effective, but impeachment's not a political issue. It's a constitutional issue. You're either going to have integrity in your constitution or you're going to have a government doing what it wants to do despite the will of the people and despite the rule of law. And so our duty to impeach is of the highest order, and the crimes that were committed in front of everybody, we can all see them. That doesn't mean that you don't insist upon a fair trial in the Senate. But if we can't see that George W. Bush has committed the supreme international crime as declared in the Nuremberg judgment, that's a war of aggression, we can't see anything. If we're afraid to indict our commander-in-chief for getting us in more trouble than we've been in a long, long time, if not ever, we've never put ourselves in this much trouble. It's amazing to hear him come back from, or not come back from Europe. As he's leaving Europe, he says, you know, it's going to be a great pleasure to tell my successor in January as president that the relationships between Europe and our America are the broadest and most vibrant that they've ever been in history. Can you believe that? And the crowd's all over the place shouting at him, Yankee, go home, or whatever they're saying. But
he seems
just,
quite oblivious,
he just said
doesn't
that.
He?
Yeah. Broadest and most vibrant. If vibrant means violent, he's right.
Trevor in Florida wants to know, Mr. Clark, will impeachment proceedings stop Bush from waging war with Iran?
Yeah, they'll make it extremely difficult. I think the only way to stop him really is to get the thing into trial in the Senate. Although if he sees 100 members of the House getting up there, he might become afraid because he'll be liable in criminal law once he leaves office for his acts. But I was saying last year, and I was saying in the early months of this year, it's important to keep him from doing other crimes. The risk of him striking Iran hadn't reached the fever heat that I consider it to be at now at that time. But this is if we don't impeach him, what will future presidents do? They'll do the same thing, won't they? They've been doing the same thing, just not in such an arrogant and deadly fashion as President Bush. I mean, this is a president that, you know, executed 152 people in Texas, never gave a single commutation. They included women. They included people who were under the age of 18, minors, in other words, in violation of international law at the time the crime was committed. Retarded people. If there's anything I can't stand, it's the execution of retarded people. How can you execute a retarded person? It's aliens in violation of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. You're supposed to tell those governments, hey, they've got a person in jeopardy over here. If they want to help them, they've got to come do it. We don't do that. We just ignore them. Because we're above the law. But anyway,
Mr. Clark, we have 3 minutes left, and there is one question from Lindsay from Iowa that I really would like to ask you. Lindsay asks, what checks and balances will prevent future criminal behaviors of the executive administration?
Well, the most important is impeachment of the leadership of this administration, beginning with President Bush, to show that we will demand accountability for criminal conduct, for high crimes and misdemeanors, for treason or bribery. If we don't do that, it's Katie bar the doors. Everybody can go their own way. And then we have to have a rigorous system of checks and balances that take corruption out of our government. My God, if you look at the billions and billions that have been swindled during all these wars and things, and the inside contracts, how many people have been killed so these oil companies can make these non-competitive contracts with a country that can't say no? How can they say no? You know, hey, please, don't take so much of our oil.
One death was too much as far as I'm concerned. What we have done is far beyond anything that could even be considered criminal. Mr. Clark, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. You've been a wealth of information. Perhaps we can invite you to come back again. We have more questions than I asked still in the holding bin, and I apologize to our listeners. We do the best we can to get all of your questions in. Thank you all for participating, and we want you to come back to our show on Monday the 20th with our guest, Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, wrestler and Navy SEAL. Next Monday, I will be interviewing David Michie, author of Buddhism for a Busy People, and we appreciate your being here. Thank you so much, Mr. Clark.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you, and keep the airwaves singing. We need you.
We're going to keep trying, I'll tell you. Thank
okay.
you all very much. Have a great night. And remember, impeach Bush.
Amen. Lots of love to everybody.
Bye-bye.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall by the relief fast, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah.